Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram weekend edition, Saturday, July 9th, 2022. Ramsey says MISD optimistic on ratings. By Stuart Doreen. Midland ISD reported this week improvement on the state's accountability star test. The first round of information showed academic performance growth, including the number of times that students in grades 3 to 8 surpassed 70% passage, from one time in 2021 to 9 times this year. Also shown was a clear dominance over Ector County Independent School District and MISD's elementary students outperforming the state on math tests. The announcement of preliminary star results followed internal metrics that showed the district demonstrating an improvement not experienced in around 5 years. We're optimistic for the August 15th school ratings that will come out, Angelica Ramsey wrote. While we cannot yet accurately predict letter grades, the growth we are seeing across the school district shows the progress being made citywide. Based on this, I feel comfortable that we have exited several D and F rated schools and will have more A and B schools than MISD has ever had under the current accountability system. Ramsey took time this week to provide more analysis of the star results and what she expects as her second full academic year approaches. Here is a question and answer session with the superintendent. What did the first round of star results mean to you? What did it tell you about the process put into place since your arrival? Our preliminary data is a testament to the hard work our teachers, staff, and leaders have put in this year. The charge from our board and community has been clear since the beginning. Make the advancement of student achievement the most important priority. Our results show that we listen to our stakeholders and quickly put plans into action. Year one has demonstrated that we are on the right track, but have a tremendous amount of work still to do. Is it accurate to say that you made learning the elementary level more uniform, everyone going in the same direction? And if so, why does that translate into greater academic achievement? An important refrain heard during my stakeholder engagement sessions in the spring of 2021 was the lack of coherence across our school district. Teachers asked for several things to help them be more successful in classroom, including district-wide professional development, a consistent workday schedule, dedicated supports at each campus, and the building of capacity of school leaders. We strengthened professional learning community training for teachers and provided coaching support for school leaders to be the lead leaders on their campuses. Coherent systems allow us to work individually on common goals, have the same language for success and areas of improvement, and allow the district to design supports in an explicit manner, all centered around learning. I am very excited the strategic plan we are taking to our school board later this month. It is the result of almost a year of listening to our stakeholders, planning, and specific strategic actions to propel MISD to the next level. MISD seemed to show more success with younger students. Is a reason for that because of the COVID impact and MISD's revolving door of permanent and interim superintendents, and therefore a lack of consistency in their education? Will it just take a little longer to reach those students? The last time Texas rated our schools, there were 19 D and F schools. Only two of those schools were at the secondary level. One of the first actions I took upon arriving was redesigning our district service center from a central office. We exist to serve the needs of our campuses. The first major branch redesigned was what was formerly known as academics. Last summer, it was reimagined as learning, leading, and innovation. We created two strong interdisciplinary teams, one for each high school feeder pattern, purple and maroon, of support for teachers and leaders. We also created the Achievement Zone initiative, in which we tiered our schools to provide them with differentiated support based on their specific needs. As we move into the 2023 school year, we are adding additional supports at the secondary level. We are adding schools to our Instructional Materials Support Initiative and our Multi-Tiered Systems of Support Initiative. Our initiatives are based in solid instructional and behavioral practices, not devices or shiny new products. In addition, our new School Improvement Officer, Miguel Serrano, is an expert at school turnaround. He has served at the middle and high school level, having taken a failing high school to exemplary status in less than 3 years. While sustainable change takes time, we're encouraged by the positive changes in year one and will work collaboratively to continue the progress. Our early results bring a sense of joy and hope. It provides momentum going into the next school year. What are you going to be looking at when the next round of data is provided, including the grades for the district and campuses? In order for results to be actionable, they must be broken down to student groups and all the way down to the student level so that support can be provided at an individual level. We are optimistic for the August 15th school ratings that will come out. While we cannot yet accurately predict letter grades, the growth we are seeing across the school district shows the progress being made citywide. Based on this, I feel comfortable that we have exited several D and F rated schools and will have more A and B schools than MISD has ever had under the current system of accountability. How much different does it feel to have your first full year under your belt? What's in store for year two? While there is positive momentum district-wide, a sense of urgency continues. We will continue to keep student achievement as the most important focus. We want our students to graduate from MISD well-rounded, with the opportunities to meet their potential academically, artistically, athletically, and socially. The work continues at a fast pace because our students deserve that from us and so much more. Volatility returned to the commodity markets in July 4th shortened week, sending crude prices below $100 a barrel. The New York Mercantile Exchange started the trading week with an $8.93 plunge, sending prices to $99.50 a barrel. That was accompanied by an additional $97 loss Wednesday. And they rose $4.20 a barrel on Thursday and added another 206 rise on Friday to end the week at $104.79. Natural gas prices on the New York MEX echoed crude's volatility following 3 of 4 trading days. Prices fell to 26.3 cents to close at 6.034 per MCF. Drilling activity rebounded after last week's decline for the fourth time in 5 weeks. Oilfield Services Baker Hughes said the count rose by 2 to 752. The number of rigs seeking crude oil was by 2 to 597, 219 more than the recounted last year. The number of rigs drilling for natural gas was unchanged at 53, more than the 101 at work a year ago. Oil and gas pay record amount in taxes again, by Mella McEwen. Record-setting revenues from Texas oil and gas production continued to flow into the state's treasury, according to data from the Texas Comptroller of Public Accounts. The office reported $679 million in oil production taxes was paid in June, up from $595 million in May and 87% above June of 2021. It was also the highest monthly collection on record. Oil production taxes total just more than $5 million to date this fiscal year, which ends August 31st. Likewise, natural gas production paid record amounts in production taxes, $439 million in June, up from $413 million in May and 176% higher than June of 2021. Natural gas production taxes to date this fiscal year totaled $3.4 million, 193% above a year earlier. Growth in oil and natural gas production in Texas, and particularly in the Permian Basin, is not only a benefit to those in the industry, but to those throughout the state, Ben Shepherd reported. The hard work and dedication of those in the industry has resulted in not only production growing to more than 40% of total crude oil production in the U.S., but record-breaking tax revenue for the state. Norma Elaine Hicks passed away on April 30th. A celebration of life will be held Saturday, July 9th at 11:30 a.m. at Christ Church Anglican in Midland. Cremation arrangements are under the direction of Natalie Picklin Welch Funeral Home. Billy Nix passed away on July 6th. Viewing will be from 9 to 5 p.m. on Monday, July 11th at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Graveside service will be at Fairview Cemetery at 11 a.m. on Tuesday, July 12th. Billy D. Baker passed away on July 3rd. Funeral service will be at 10 a.m. on Monday, July 11th at Luella Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. Graveside services will follow at Rest Haven Cemetery. Emilia C. Navarrete passed away in early July. Her viewing will take place at Luella Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home on Sunday, July 10th from 1 to 9 p.m. Rosary will take place at the funeral home Sunday evening at 7 p.m. The funeral will be at Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Church on Monday, July the 11th at 2 p.m. Enrique Flores passed away on July 2nd. Visiting hours will be Saturday, July 9th from 3 to 8 p.m. and Sunday, July 10th from 1 to 8 p.m., with the prayer service beginning at 6 p.m. on Sunday at Willowbrook Funeral Home in Midland. Services will be at 10 a.m. Tuesday at First Assembly of God Church in Midland. Jafar Jeff Salehi passed away on June 21st. The family will receive guests from 5 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, July 14th at The Branch at Nellie Pickleton Welsh Funeral Home. A celebration of life will be held July 15th at 11 a.m. at First Presbyterian Church. His final resting place will be his ranch in the Hill Country. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickleton Welsh Funeral Home. Jeshun Jurail Anders passed away. Visitation will be Friday, July 15th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Avalos Sanchez Funeral Home. Funeral service will be Saturday, July 16th at 1 p.m. at Goodwill Missionary Baptist Church. Interment will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Ron Taylor passed away on June the 12th. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. on July the 9th at the Chapel of the First Presbyterian Church of Midland. Saul Bernal Sr. passed away on July 6th. A prayer service will be at 7 p.m. Sunday, July 10th at Nellie Pickleton Welsh Funeral Home. Funeral service will be at 10 a.m. Monday, July 11th at Iglesia Bautista Monte Sinai. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickleton Welsh Funeral Home. Louis Stallings passed away on July the 1st. A viewing will be at Nellie Pickleton Welsh Funeral Home on Big Spring from 9 to 5 p.m. on July 5th, and visitation from 5 to 7 that evening. Services are scheduled for July 6th at 2 p.m. at Nellie Pickle Rosewood Chapel in Big Spring. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickleton Welsh Funeral Home. Aurelio Gonzalez passed away on July the 6th. Viewing is scheduled for Monday, July 11th at Luella Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home from 4 to 9 p.m. Rosary is at 7 p.m. A mass will be celebrated on Tuesday, July 12th at Our Lady of Guadalupe Church. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickleton Welsh Funeral Home. Caitlin Claire Cat Pazze passed away unexpectedly at her home in New Zealand on March 24th. Cat was born in Midland on May the 29th, 1979. A rosary will be held at St. Stephen's Catholic Church in Midland on Wednesday, July the 13th at 7 p.m. Funeral mass will be at St. Stephen's on Thursday, July 14th at 11 p.m. A private interment service will follow at St. Anne's Catholic Church.
This is Jane reading for the Odessa American from Saturday, July 9th. Thompson floats ODC revenue bond idea. Odessa City Councilman Steve Thompson says he believes he might just have the answer to how the city can help pay for improved roads and water infrastructure, but whether it's legal remains up for discussion. Thompson would like the council to consider issuing revenue bonds through the Odessa Development Corporation. The councilman said the Economic Development Group has roughly $23 to $25 million in uncommitted funds, and a portion of it could be used to address Odessa's aging water system and or to improve Odessa's roads without impacting taxpayers. The ODC uses sales tax revenues to provide companies with incentives to move to Odessa, but the grants they provide are paid on a staggered basis, so there is always funding available. What we should do is use the sales tax money to service the debt, Thompson said. That doesn't add anything to our taxpayers, and that's the most important thing. Thompson said Midland's Economic Development Corporation routinely sets aside 30% of its funding for infrastructure needs, and Odessa can consider doing that as well. I think it's paramount that we try to get ahead of the curve here. For 2 years, I've been on this council, and so far, all we do is play catch-up, Thompson said during Tuesday afternoon's council workshop. It's time to identify projects and dedicate money toward them, he said. For example, because of all the growth in the area, he'd like to expand Yukon Road to create more retail opportunities and sales tax revenues. Between using ODC funds and American Rescue Plan Act funds, Thompson said the city could address a lot of needs, noting that the city is expecting roughly $13 to $14 million in ARPA funds. I can see it being a series of bonds over the years. Because of our good faith and credit that the city enjoys, those interest rates are pretty reasonable. We could use up, as an example, $35 million, and if sales taxes continue to grow or not is obligated. It might be a 1 year deal, or 2 years, or 3 years, or it might happen next year if things continue to do like they're doing, Thompson said. ODC Chairman David Booten is hopeful the corporation will be able to help. I think it's a little bit early for me to say if it's doable. I think we still got to cross the T's and dot some I's, but it's definitely worth exploring, Booten said. I want to make sure that we continue to meet our mission, that we don't do anything playing outside that. But we're all exploring opportunities because the city's growing, and if we can help that growth, that certainly helps the economy expand and helps us bring in workforce and new businesses and all that kind of stuff. The law states the funding can only be used for infrastructure for specific projects intended to spur economic development, such as the Nacero project, Crow said. However, Crow said if he can be proven wrong, he'd be the biggest champion behind Thompson's idea. You'd have to show me in black and white, he said. Odessa Councilman Mark Mata suspects Crow might be right. However, if Crow is wrong, he is intrigued by the idea of setting a certain percentage of OCD funding aside for infrastructure. He's opposed to revenue bonds, though. Expenditures of that size need to be approved by citizens, Mata said. Councilwoman Deidre White would also like to look into Thompson's idea of revenue bonds, but only as a catch-up measure, as she wouldn't like the city to rely on the extra funding indefinitely. Thompson, Mata, and White all noted how difficult it will be in the coming months to determine how to meet all of the growing city's needs. On top of needing to address the city's streets, water lines, and sewer lines, the council was recently presented with a 5-year plan that includes a possible sports complex, which would cost an estimated $28 to $40 million, excluding the 100-plus acres to build it on. Mayor Javier Hoven suggested in July 2021 that the city could pay for the sports complex with a voter-approved bond measure, and last month he floated the idea of placing a city water and sewer underground infrastructure bond on the ballot, along with a citywide road rebuild bond and a sewer plant bond. However, voters solidly rejected an Ector County Independent School District bond measure that would have paid for a new high school and career and technical education center. issuing additional certificates of obligation is an option, but there was a lot of fierce debate before the last one was approved to fund rehabilitating the city's water treatment facility. Many council members wanted the issue to be decided by voters before ultimately voting 6-1 to issue the debt. Hoven did not return a message seeking comment for this story. This is Jane reading for the Odessa American for Saturday, July 9th. MCHS offers fully funded scholarships to UTPB School of Nursing. The University of Texas Permian Basin School of Nursing is celebrating a generous nursing scholarship made possible by Medical Center Health System, a press release detailed. The scholarship is available for UTPB nursing students. MCHS will pay tuition, fees, and books to students who are accepted into the UTPB Bachelor of Science Nursing Program, fill out the Medical Center Hospital application for scholarship, and are accepted through the application process. Students who receive funding must commit to working at Medical Center Health System for 2 years after they graduate. Students who are awarded one of these generous MCHS scholarships will have the freedom from working a full-time job while earning their nursing degree, said Dr. Donna Buick, Dean of the College of Health Sciences and Human Performance. It's a great opportunity for students to earn their nursing degree debt-free. We are so thankful for this investment in nurses who will serve the needs of Odessa and surrounding communities. Students only have to apply for the MCHS scholarship one time. Once awarded, UTPB's School of Nursing will notify MCHS of the student's progress in the program. Funding for this scholarship is available beginning fall 2022. Graduating quality nurses is imperative for this community, said Kristen Abbott-Timmons, Chief Nursing Officer at Medical Center System. There is a nursing shortage across the nation, and our service area is in dire need of increasing the number of baccalaureate-level nurses who will care for this region's growing and aging population. The application process is now open. Students interested in the Medical Center Hospital Nursing Scholarship can apply now. For additional information on the MCHS Nursing Scholarship, please call 432-640-2171. This is Jane reading for the OA for Saturday, July 9th. New trustee looks forward to challenge. Since he reads a minimum of 4 newspapers every morning, new Ector County ISD Board of Trustees member Dennis Jones isn't worried about the amount of homework he'll be doing as part of the panel. Jones, who is also an attorney and former judge, was appointed to the board during their June 21st meeting. Having grown up in Lufkin, Jones has been in Odessa for 17 years. When he was born, his parents lived in Monahans. His father was in the Air Force stationed at Paiute. Jones started college at Sam Houston State University in Huntsville and graduated from Stephen F. Austin University in Nacogdoches with a bachelor's degree in criminal justice. He went to law school at South Texas College of Law in downtown Houston. He started off as a business major, but later changed to pursuing law. It's something my father always wanted me to do. He didn't have the opportunities that people have now to go to college. I was the first one in my family to be fortunate enough to attend and graduate college, and it's always something he had a dream for me. And I just kind of said, okay, Jones said. Although his father was not a college graduate, he was elected county judge in Angelina County, so Jones grew up around the courthouse. Then I went to Angelina College in Lufkin, which is much like Odessa College here, and I was the director of the criminal justice and paralegal degree programs. Once I tired of that, I started applying around the state for other prosecutor jobs, and I got hired here in Ector County by Kathy Lynch, who was the county attorney in 2005. That's what brought me here. When he received a mailer from the ECISD about the board opening, he realized he was in District 7. It was something my wife and I talked about. I ran for district judge earlier in the year and didn't win that race. It's kind of ironic timing for this, but it's just something that I felt I needed to give back to the community. Odessa has been very good to me since I've been here, and I'm just attempting to give a small measure back by trying to serve the community in some capacity. I think that our current board has been very good, very drama-free, and I want to continue that, Jones said. He knows board members Tammy Hawkins and Carol Gregg from being a municipal court judge. Gregg also was a municipal court judge, and Hawkins was director of the teen court program. Jones said he knows Steve Brown from when he worked with the district before he retired. For those 13 years I was at municipal court, I did the truancy program all of those times, so I got familiar with a few of the employees and staff of the district. That's how I know him, Jones said. Hawkins said she was fortunate to know Jones when he was a judge, and she was at Odessa Teen Court. One of the biggest areas that some people can find intimidating is the Open Meetings Act, and I intend to fully comply with that. I think it's an important piece of legislation that was done many years ago. I don't think it needs to be weakened or changed. I'm all for that because the public, we're spending their tax dollars. The public has a right to know how their dollars are being spent. I'm a big proponent of that. But I hope that I can bring a different perspective than maybe someone else with my background and my expertise, Jones said. This is Jane reading for the Odessa American for Saturday, July 9th. Permian grad, happy to be back in Odessa. For Dr. Jason Jones, the feeling that he's finally finished with 6 years of medical school hasn't quite sunk in yet. The Permian grad is happy to be at the end of a long road that included 4 years of undergraduate studies, 4 years of dental school, and 6 years of medical school. He is even happier to be back in the Permian Basin. Jones, who now works as an oral and maxillofacial surgeon in the Permian Basin Oral Surgery and Dental Implant Center, made his return to Odessa along with his wife, Isabel Jones, and three kids, Daniel, David, and Samuel. Jones finished his residency on June 25th. The moving was probably a month-long process because I was finishing my residency and I was doing a rotation in El Paso. So I was in El Paso and my wife and kids were in San Antonio. We were going back and forth between there and Odessa for the last 3 or 4 weeks of residency. We moved in officially on July 3rd weekend. A 2008 graduate of Permian who played at center for the Panther football team, Jones stayed close to his home for his undergrad, graduating from the University of Texas Permian Basin in 2012. After that, Jones spent the next 4 years at UTHSCSA Dental School before graduating in May. He then went to UT Health San Antonio, where he graduated in 2019, and then spent the next 3 years on residency. It's still a little surreal, I guess, Jones said about his first week on the job here in Odessa. We were working with patients early on, and we've been working with patients since dental school, but the fact that now I'm doing it semi on my own, it still feels odd. It doesn't feel real yet. Jones' fascination with being an oral surgeon began back when he was in high school, where his friend's dad was also an oral maxillofacial surgeon. It really is a unique career path to become an oral surgeon, Jones said. The way we weave in and out of medicine and dentistry is kind of odd and unique to our field. That said, my family and wife's family were very supportive of us and would come visit us. We're blessed to have family support us. He's also excited to be back home in Odessa. I'm happy to be back, and I feel like I'm in a good place, and I'm happy with what I'm doing, Jones said. This is Jane reading from the Odessa American for Saturday, July 9th. Letters to the editor. Inflation doesn't make a lot of sense. I have watched my retirement IRA diminish by over 25% in the past few months, while the cost of gas, food, and other commodities have skyrocketed. I have listened to the president and the so-called experts try to explain what is happening, and it doesn't make a lot of sense. I just received my mid-year IRA statement, and the capital gains and dividends paid out exceed what I have gotten the past couple of years. What is going on? It must be that companies are doing well as people continue to buy, but it is the poor and retired on fixed incomes that are suffering. I would like someone to explain the following scenario that I just experienced on a trip from Odessa to Las Cruces, New Mexico, to attend a conference. In that 320-mile ride, I got to counting and figured in the five-hour stretch of time we were on the road, there were almost 4,000 semi-trucks going each way delivering goods to stores, and the same on the return trip. Can you imagine how many trucks that would be in a day, and that's only a minuscule stretch of highway? At the eastbound border patrol station, the line of trucks waiting to be checked was over a mile long. Going to Las Cruces, I was fascinated to see 24 trucks carrying blade for wind production turbines to generate electricity being transported east. I wonder how much diesel fuel it took to deliver them to where they were going, and how long it will take for them to produce enough electricity to pay for their transport. As fuel prices rise, I can see why other costs rise also. Given the restraints the oil companies are under from the government, I think the biggest problem is we can't produce enough fossil fuel, and until the government changes those policies, inflation is here to stay, no matter what the Fed or anyone else does. I wish some of those coastal liberals would come to West Texas and see how the world and economy actually works. Charles Cotton of Odessa. This is Jane reading for the Saturday Odessa American for July 9th. Southwest Bank announces new oil and gas department, new personnel. Southwest Bank announced on Friday the creation of its new oil and gas department and the appointment of two new employees as the bank looks to provide specific support to a major industry in the region. The recent addition of Richard Davis Browning II and Wes Webb strengthened Southwest Bank's commitment to serving the oil and gas market. Webb accepted the position of Senior Vice President, Commercial Lender. He has over 25 years of experience in energy lending. Previously, he served as Senior Vice President, Account Officer at First Oklahoma Bank and as Senior Vice President and Manager at Bank of Oklahoma for 12 years. Webb has a bachelor's degree from the University of Texas, Permian Basin. Browning accepted the position of Vice President, Commercial Lender. He has been involved with oil and gas production financing in the Dallas area for the last 7 years, and most recently served as a portfolio manager with Texas Capital Bank. Browning began his banking career as an energy analyst with Comerica and moved into underwriting and portfolio management with Texas Capital Bank's Energy Finance Division. He holds a bachelor's degree from Texas Christian University. We are so excited to announce the creation of our new oil and gas department and the lenders that will make this department successful. We are continuously looking at how we can build our staff with high-quality people that provide superior service to our customers, Dewey Bryant, CEO, stated in the press release. We welcome these individuals to the Southwest Bank family, and I am confident they will make a positive impact in our markets that will well position us in the years to come. This is Jane reading for the Saturday Odessa American from the obituary and death notice section. In Odessa, Gary Lee Wise, 84, passed away on Wednesday, July 6th. Gary was born to Max and Yvonne Wise in Brooksmith, Texas on June 10th, 1938. He graduated from Brooksmith High School in 1956 and attended Texas Tech University. Later, he moved to New Mexico, where he met his wife of 61 years, Joy Irby Wise. The couple moved to Odessa in 1970 with four children. Gary worked in the oil and gas industry for over 50 years and was widely known and appreciated throughout the industry. He created numerous businesses while building strong relationships and lasting friendships throughout the region. Professionally, Gary was known as a hard worker in the industry and was willing to support others in their endeavors. Gary's quick wit will be missed, but he will be remembered as a husband, brother, father, grandfather, and a friend. He worked hard and played hard doing things he loved. Gary is survived by his wife, Joy Wise, sister Kay Vogel, and husband Jody of Burleson, Texas, his daughter Shannon and husband Tom Duncan of Hobbs, his daughter Lachelle and husband Steve Curran of McKinney, his daughter Tana and husband Richard Kennedy of McKinney. Gary was preceded in death by his parents, his son, and brothers. Gary's ashes will be laid to rest at a private family cemetery in New Mexico. In Odessa, Aaron Robert White, 17, died on Sunday, July 3rd, in Crane. Services are pending with Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. Margaret Louise Perkins of Odessa, at 74, died Monday, July 4th, in Midland. Services are pending with Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. In Odessa, Gerald Wayne Taylor, 83, died Friday, July 1st, in Odessa. No services have been scheduled. Arrangements are by Willowbrook Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Midland. Loretta Diane Walker, 63, died Tuesday, July 5th, in Odessa. Services are pending with Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. Adrian Elijah White, 19, died Sunday, July 3rd, in Crane. Services are pending with Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa.
Good morning, friends. This is Julie reading from the Odessa American, Sunday, July 10th. Abe's death raises security questions as Japan mourns, the Associated Press, Tokyo. A top police official on Saturday acknowledged possible security lapses that allowed an assassin to fire his gun into former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe while he was addressing a campaign rally, raising questions how could the attacker get so close behind him. Abe was shot in the western city of Nara on Friday and airlifted to a hospital but died of blood loss. Police arrested the attacker, a former member of Japan's Navy, at the scene. Police confiscated his homemade gun and several others were later found at his apartment. The attacker, Toshiba Yasamgami, told investigators he acted because he believed rumors that Abe was connected to an organization that he resents, police said. Japanese media reported that the man had developed hatred towards a religious group and that his mother was obsessed and caused his family financial problems. The reports did not specify the group. On Saturday, a black hearse carrying Abe's body and accompanied by his wife, Eki, arrived at his home in Tokyo's upscale residential area in Shibuya. Many mourners, including top party officials, waited for his remains and lowered their heads as the vehicle passed. Nara Prefecturally Police Chief Tomokachi Ozuka said Abe's assassination was his greatest regret in his 27-year career. I cannot deny that there are problems with our security, Ozuki said. Whether it was a setup, emergency response, or ability of individuals, we still have to find out. Overall, there was a problem, and we will review it from every perspective. Abe's assassination ahead of Sunday's parliamentary election shocked the nation and raised questions over whether security for the former prime minister was adequate. Some observers who watched videos of the attack noted a lack of attention in the open space behind Abe as he spoke. A former Kotu Prefectural Officer investigation, Komatsu Higuchi, said the footage suggested security was sparse at the event and insufficient for a former prime minister. It is necessary to investigate why the security allowed Yamaguchi to freely move and go about Mr. Abe. Hichi told the Nippon TV talk show. Experts also said Abe was very vulnerable standing on the ground level instead of atop a campaign vehicle, which is usually the case, but was reportedly unavailable due to his hastily arranged visit to Nara. Looks like police were mainly focusing on front yard, while paying little attention to what's behind Mr. Abe, and nobody stopped the suspect approaching him, said a crisis management professor at Nihon University. Clearly, there was a problem. The election campaign provided a chance for voters and politicians to interact because Political terrorism was extremely rare in post-war Japan, but Abe's assassination could prompt stricter security over crowded events like campaigns, sports games, and others. During a parliamentary debate in 2015, Abe resisted suggestions by opposition lawmaker to beef up his security. Instead of that, he said, "Japan is a safe country." In videos circulating on social media, the 41-year-old can be seen standing only a few meters, yards away behind Abe, across a busy street and continuously glancing around. A few minutes after Abe stood at the podium and started his speech, a local party candidate and their supporters stood and waved to the crowd. Yamagami can be seen taking his gun out of the bag, walking towards Abe and firing the first shot, which released a cloud of smoke, but the projectile apparently missed Abe. As Abe turned to see where the noise came from, a second shot went off. The bullet apparently hit Abe's left arm, missing a bulletproof briefcase raised by a security guard who stood behind him. Abe fell to the ground, with his left arm tucked in as if to cover his chest. Campaign organizers shouted through loudspeakers, asking for medical expert to provide first aid to Abe. His heart and breathing had stopped by the time he was airlifted to the hospital, where he was later pronounced dead. Police said Saturday said an autopsy result showed that a bullet had entered Abe's upper left arm, damaged arteries beneath both collarbones, causing fatal massive bleeding. According to the newspaper, Amagani was contract worker at the warehouse in Komotu, operating a forklift. He was described as a quiet person who did not mingle with colleagues. A next-door neighbor at his apartment told reporters he never met Yamagami, though he recalled hearing noises like he saw being used several times late in the night over the past month. Japan is particularly known for its strict gun laws. With a population of 125 million, it has only 10 gun-related criminal cases last year, 8 of them gang-related. Even though he was out of office, Abe was still highly influential in governing Liberal Democratic Party and headed its largest faction, but his ultralistic views made him a divisive figure to many. Abe stepped down 2 years ago, blaming a recurrence of the ulcerative colitis he'd had since he was a teenager. He said he regretted his leave, many of his goals unfinished, especially his failure to resolve the issue of Japan abducted last year by North Korea, a territorial dispute with Russia, as the revision of Japan's war renouncing constitution. The ultranationalism rifled the Koreans and China, and his push to create what he saw as a more normal defense posture angered many Japanese liberals. Abe failed to achieve his cherished goal of formally rewriting the U.S. drafted Pacific Constitution because of poor public support. Loyalists said his legacy was a strong U.S.-Japan relationship that was meant to bolster Japan's defense capacity. Abe divided the public by forcing his defense goals and other contentious issues through Parliament. China leaders Xi Jinping, who early on had a frosty relationship with Abe, sent a condolence message to Japan Prime Minister on Saturday, a day after most other world leaders issued their statements. He credited Abe with making efforts to improve China-Japan relations and said he and Abe had reached an important understanding on building better ties, according to the statement posted on China's foreign ministry website. He also said he was willing to work with him to continue to develop neighborly and cooperative relationships. Abe was groomed to follow in the footsteps of his grandfather, the former prime minister. His political rhetoric often focused on making Japan a normal and beautiful nation with a stronger military through security alliances with the United States and bigger role in international affairs. He became Japan's youngest prime minister in 2006 at the age of 52, but his overwhelmingly nationalistic first stint abruptly ended a year later, also because of his health, prompting 6 years of annual leadership change. He returned to office in 2012, vowing to revitalize the nation, getting its economy out of the deflation doldrums with his Abenomics formula, which combines fiscal stimulation, monetary easing, and structural reform. He won 6 national elections and built a rock-solid grip on power. The Hive Goes Live. Comic Book Store Finds New Market by Roel McGregor. James Law, the owner and operator of the Hive Comics, stayed away from auctioning items online. He says he didn't want to deal with packaging, shipping, and a lack of customer interaction. That was until Law completed his first Whatnot auction on June 25th, where he sold 54 action figures. About a week after his first Whatnot auction, Law held a second auction on June 30th, where he sold 150 comics. "I really haven't done any online sales," Law said. "I didn't really want to ship stuff out. I didn't want to do it, but I had five or six people tell me whatnot. I went on the app. I love the layout. I love the interaction ability. I felt like it was my store selling to the people in the store, even though I wasn't. The experience of it was completely different than just having an online store where people buy stuff you ship out to them. Platform and allows buyers and sellers to interact with each other. Items can be sold on Whatnot, range from trading cards to comics to clothing to autographs to NFTs. Law said he was found items that go for less than market value on Whatnot, which he said that has he's a fan of. "Over the past years, everything was really gone up in value," Law said. "The collectible market has seen a great upturn in value. The Whatnot app is giving a little bit more level playing field." Not only has Whatnot allowed Laws to clear out inventory of comics and action figures, but it's also helped him garner a wider audience. Law says his number of followers from the first action to the second auction jumped from 36 to 103. Law can also see buyers' location, and he said after the comic book auction, there were 24 different buyers, and seven of those were from outside of Texas. "It was pretty eye-opening to see the many people buying from outside Texas, but it was also humbling to see other local customers getting on Whatnot and buying from us," Law said. Law said he was going to average one auction a week, but he said the goal is to eventually do five auctions per week, with each of the 5 days being its own category. So one day will be comics, another will be action figures, another will be graded comics, another day will be trading cards. "I want to end up doing five a week with five different themes," Law said. The High Comics often in 2016, and Law's brought the store in November of 2019. In addition to selling comics, trading cards, and action figures, Law said the comic book store hosts weekly Magic, The Gathering, and the Yu-Gi-Oh! Tournament. Law said about 12 to 18 people show up on Friday, while 8 to 12 people come during Monday and Tuesday. "We have a comic supplies, card supplies to protect your cards and comics," Law said. "We have high-end comics. We have weekly comics." How a crowded GOP field could help Trump in 2024, the Associated Press, New York. As Donald Trump considers another White House run, polls show he's the most popular figure in the Republican Party. But it wasn't always that way. Competing at one point against dozens of rivals for the presidential nomination in 2016, Trump won only about one-third of the vote in key early states. He even lost in Iowa, which kicks off the nomination process. But he's prevailed because those in the party who opposed his brand of divisive politics were never able to coalesce around a single rival. That same dynamic could repeat itself as Trump mulls over a new bid for the presidency as soon as this summer. With a growing list of candidates gearing up to run, even a Trump diminished by two impeachments and mounting legal vulnerabilities could hold a commanding position in a fractured multi-candidate primary. "I fear it could end up the same way as 2016, which basically was anyone thought anyone else could get out," said Republican strategist Mike Yuhami, who advised former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's campaign last year. "I think every major candidate realizes he or she could have a better shot against Trump on set one. But of course, each person thought he or she could be the one to get the shot. Nobody got out that way. And then it was too late." The anxiety is mounting as a growing list of potential rivals take increasingly brazen steps, delivering high-profile speeches, running ads, courting donors, and making repeated visits to early voting states. That group now includes upwards of a dozen could-be candidates, including Trump's former Vice President Mike Pence, his former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, Tom Cotton of Arkansas, Rick Scott of Florida, and Tim Scott of South Carolina. all could run on the former president's policies. In the anti-Trump lane, politicians such as Republican Liz Cheney of Wyoming and Maryland Governor Larry Hogan are raising their profiles. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is increasingly seen as Trump's heir apparent, even by Trump's most loyal supporters, and viewed by Trump's allies as his most fundamental potential challenger. Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley and others have said that they will not challenge Trump if he does go forward, but others, including Christie, seem to be gunning for the fight, even if they seem to be a long shot. I'm definitely giving it serious thought. I'm not going to make any decision probably until the end of the year, Christie said in a recent interview. He has urged the party to move on from Trump and his ongoing obsession with the 2020 election. For me, it's about the party needing to go in a new direction from a personality perspective and to continue to have someone who can bring strong leadership, though leadership that the country needs but doesn't have all that other drama that goes along with it, he said. I'm hearing the same thing from donors and hearing it from voters, that we're very concerned that we can put ourselves in a position to have 2024 be anything but the good of the country. Campeo, who has a busy travel schedule and plans to return to Iowa this summer, said in a recent interview that he's been spending time reading and listening to President Ronald Reagan's speeches as he prepares for a possible run. We're getting ready to stay in the fight, he said last month, as he courted evangelical Christians at a gathering in Nashville, Tennessee. He said he and his wife would sit down after November election and think our way through it, pray our way through it, and decide what's best to serve. It could be presenting ourselves for election office again. We may choose a different path, but we're not going to walk away from these things I've been working on for 30 years now. They matter too much. Pompeo sketched out a possible approach in much the same way as Trump. He was a disruptor that was most necessary in 2016. There's no doubt about that, Pompeo said. And now the task is to take those set for understanding, those set of principles, and defend them and build upon them. And it's going to take a lot of work to do that. Leaders of the real fortitude and character do that. Such open talk comes as Trump faces a cascade of escalating legal troubles. The Congressional Committee investigates the January 6th insurrection has revealed increasingly damaging information about Trump's final weeks in office. The Department of Justice has its own investigation. In Georgia, the prosecutor investigating Trump's potentially legal meddling in the state's 2020 election has stepped up her inquiry by subpoenaing members of Trump's inner circle. In New York, Trump, his namesake son, and his daughter Ivanka have agreed to answer questions under oath being the next week in the state attorney general's civil investigation into his business practices. Possible threat raises fear in San Antonio Jewish community. The Associated Press, San Antonio. Jewish community leaders in San Antonio had put synagogues and other facilities in high alert Saturday after being informed by the FBI of a potential threat. But hours later, the Jewish Federation of San Antonio said the FBI had informed it if there was no longer any known imminent threat for the local Jewish community. Although we recommend staying vigilant and aware of your surroundings at all times, we are pleased to share that the urgency of concern has been lowered, the Federation said on the Facebook post. Earlier Saturday, the group had said all former religious gatherings in the San Antonio area were canceled due to security concerns. In a statement, the FBI said it had been investigating a potential threat targeting an unidentified synagogue in Texas. Jonathan Greenblatt, the CEO of Anti-Defamation League, said he urged all communities to have a heightened sense of awareness, particularly in the wake of the deadly Independence Day parade shooting in suburban Chicago. Production resumes at troubled Abbott Baby Formula Factory, the Associated Press. Production of baby formula has resumed at the Abbott Nutrition Factory in Michigan, whose February shutdown over contaminations contributed to the national shortage, a company spokesman said. Damage from several thunderstorms, including flooding, had forced the Sturgis plant to halt operations in mid-June, just 2 weeks after restarting production with additional sanitized and safety protocols. Production of Elicare, a specialty formula for infants, with severe food allergies and digestive problems, restored at Sturgis following the July 1st reboot, said Abbott spokesman John Cavall. We are working to restart Similac products as soon as we can. We'll provide more information when we have it, he said via email. Abbott recalls several leading brands of formula in February, including Similac, that squeezed supplies already been strained by supply chain disruption and stockpiling during the COVID-19 shutdowns. The shortage was most dire for children with allergies, digestive problems, and metabolic disorders who rely on specialty formulas. President Joe Biden's administration has since eased import rules for foreign manufacturers, airlifted formula from Europe, and invoked federal emergency rules to prioritize U.S. production. Abbott is one of just four companies that produce about 90% of U.S. formulas. Cavall declined to say how much Abbott's overall U.S. supply of infant formula is produced at the Sturgis plant. The plant was closed in February after the Food and Drug Administration began investigating four bacterial infections among infants who consumed powdered formula from the plant. Two of the babies died. The company said its products had been directly linked to the infections, which involved different bacterial strains. FDA inspectors eventually uncovered a host of violations at the plant, including bacterial contamination, a leaky roof, and lax safety protocols. On Wednesday, the Food and Drug Administration announced plans to help overseas makers of infant formula that have sent supplies under emergency approval to address the shortage, secure long-term authorization to market their formula in the U.S. The plan is to provide Americans' consumers with more choices and make supplies more resilient against current or future shortages. FDA Commissioner Dr. Robert Califf and Susan Main, the director of Agency's Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition, said in a statement that the Sturgis plant shutdown, compounded by unforeseen natural weather events, has shown just how vulnerable the supply chain has become.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.